To the north, it was a crushing defeat, a senseless slaughter, a bloodbath. To the south, it was a glorious victory that underscored the superiority of Southern arms. To civilians who lost their homes and their belongings, it was a tragedy. The battle was Fredericksburg. Hello, my name's Donald Fines. I'm the staff historian here at Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. For the next 2 or 3 hours, I'd like to lead you on a driving tour of the Fredericksburg battlefield. The tour consists of 12 stops. At the end of each stop, you'll receive directions to the next point on the tour, followed by a tone. Beep! When you hear the tone, turn off your player and turn it back on when you reach the next stop. Ignore the battlefield tour signs that you'll see as you drive around the battlefield. They follow a different tour. Now, if you're ready, let's begin. To reach the first stop on the tour, exit the Fredericksburg Battlefield Visitor Center parking lot and turn left onto Lafayette Boulevard. You'll pass through 4 stoplights. You want to go straight through the intersection at each of these lights. To do so, stay in the right lane at the first light, the left lane at the second and third lights, and the right lane at the fourth light. After you pass the 4th stoplight, Lafayette Boulevard ends at Sophia Street. Turn right onto Sophia and proceed to the parking lot at the end of the road. Park facing the Rappahannock River. You are now at stop 1, the city dock. November 10, 1862 was a sad and momentous day in the Army of the Potomac as officers and soldiers gathered to bid farewell to George B. McClellan. For a year, McClellan had been the Army's commander. He had reorganized the Army after its humiliating defeat at Bull Run in July of 1861, and he had later led it to the gates of Richmond. He had molded the Army in his image, and it loved him. Unfortunately, President Abraham Lincoln did not share the Army's admiration of McClellan. While he appreciated the general's organizational ability, he recognized that McClellan lacked the boldness and imagination necessary to wield the Army in battle. By the fall of 1862, Lincoln determined to replace McClellan with Major General Ambrose E. Burnside, a 38-year-old friend of McClellan's, who at that time was in command of the Army's Ninth Corps. Twice before in the summer of 1862, Lincoln had asked Burnside to take command of the Army, in the wake of the Seven Days Campaign, and again after the Second Battle of Manassas. Both times, Burnside had declined. He argued that he was not competent to command an army of 100,000 men. Just as important, perhaps, he did not want to betray his friend McClellan. After the Battle of Antietam, however, Lincoln determined that McClellan had to go. On November 7th, he directed General-in-Chief Henry Halleck to write an order relieving McClellan of command and putting Burnside in his place. With the order came the understanding that Burnside would take action before winter set in. Burnside had no choice but to obey the President's order, although he made it clear that he did so against his wishes. "The General-in-Chief will readily comprehend the embarrassments which surround me in taking command of this army, at this place, and at this season of the year," he wrote. "Had I been asked to take it, I should have declined. But, being ordered, I cheerfully obey." The Army of the Potomac was then clustered near Warrenton, Virginia, 30 miles to your left as you face the Rappahannock River. The Army had 6 corps totaling 115,000 men. Upon taking command, Burnside grouped the corps into 3 grand divisions, commanded by Generals William B. Franklin, Joseph Hooker, and Edwin V. Sumner. Lee's army, by contrast, had just 2 corps, numbering 78,000 men. James Longstreet commanded one of the corps. Stonewall Jackson commanded the other. Longstreet was then at Culpeper, blocking Burnside's direct advance on Richmond by way of the Orange and Alexandria Railroad. Jackson was west of the Blue Ridge Mountains, in the Shenandoah Valley, where he threatened the flank and rear of the Union Army. Rather than attack Longstreet near Culpeper, Burnside determined to move east and cross the Rappahannock River here at Fredericksburg. Once across, he could march on Richmond using the Rappahannock or other navigable rivers to supply his army. The trouble was getting across the Rappahannock. The Confederate Army had destroyed the town's bridges, forcing Burnside to use portable bridges called pontoons. Unfortunately, McClellan had left the pontoons back at the Potomac River, 50 miles to the rear. Undeterred, Burnside arranged for Halleck to ford the bridges to him at Fredericksburg. Confident that Halleck would send the bridges promptly, Burnside and his army started east. Sumner's Grand Division led the march. When it reached Fredericksburg on November 17th, it found fewer than 1,000 Confederates guarding the town. Sumner ordered his troops to ford the Rappahannock at Falmouth, 2 miles to your left, and seize Fredericksburg. But Burnside overruled him. The pontoon bridges had not yet arrived, and without them, Burnside feared that Sumner's Grand Division might be cut off from the rest of the army and destroyed. He prudently decided to await the arrival of the pontoons before sending his army across the river. Unfortunately, the bridges were late. By the time they arrived, 1 week later, Longstreet's corps occupied the heights behind Fredericksburg, rendering passage of the river immeasurably more difficult. For Burnside, there would be no easy crossing of the Rappahannock. For 2 weeks, the Union commander studied his maps. He finally decided to cross the river at Skinker's Neck, 14 miles downriver, to your right. He had hardly put his army in motion, however, before large numbers of Confederates appeared at the crossing site. Burnside abruptly canceled the movement and instead ordered the army to cross at Fredericksburg in the hope that a crossing there would catch Lee off guard. Engineers started laying 5 bridges opposite the town before dawn on December 11th, one of which was here at the city dock. After 3 weeks of planning, the Union commander was finally ready to make his move. Return to Sophia Street and drive 7 blocks to the stoplight at William Street, also known as Route 3. Turn right at the light and cross the Rappahannock River. As you do so, get into your left-hand lane. When you reach the stoplight at the far end of the bridge, 2 lanes will turn left. Get in the far left-hand lane. Turn left at the light onto Chatham Heights Road and proceed to the first street, Chatham Lane. A brown National Park Service sign stands at the corner there. Turn left onto Chatham Lane and proceed to the visitor parking area at the end of the road. Park facing the field so that the greenhouses are to your left front.
Beep!
You are now at stop 2, Chatham. Just beyond the trees, to your left, lies Chatham, one of Virginia's most elegant plantation houses. Planter William Fitzhugh built the house beginning in 1768, and it remained in private ownership until 1975. In its nearly 250-year history, it has hosted many important individuals, including 3 presidents. One of those presidents was Abraham Lincoln, who met with Union generals here in May of 1862, 7 months before the Battle of Fredericksburg, during an earlier occupation of the town. The house then belonged to the Lacys, a slaveholding family of staunch Southern loyalties. The Lacys left their home when the Union Army first arrived in Fredericksburg and did not return until the war was over. General Sumner occupied the building as his headquarters during the Battle of Fredericksburg, and Union surgeons later used it as a field hospital. Claire Barton nursed wounded Union soldiers here, and poet Walt Whitman came to the house in search of a wounded brother. The house suffered heavy damage as a result of its military use. When the Lacys returned to Chatham in 1865, they found their windows and doors broken, bloodstains on their floors, and graffiti scrawled on their walls. Outside, soldiers had trampled the Lacys' gardens, burned their fence rails, and cut down their trees. More than 130 soldiers who had died at the house had been buried on the grounds in shallow graves. For many years, Chatham languished. Later owners restored the house, however, and in 1975, its last owner, John Lee Pratt, gave the property to the National Park Service. Today, the house and grounds are open to the public at no charge. I encourage you to visit the house. After you finish looking around inside, walk down to the terraces in front of the building, where you'll get an excellent view of Fredericksburg and the Rappahannock River. The town looks very much today as it did in 1862. The 3 steeples that you'll see were all standing at that time. Just behind the town is the wooded ridge known as Marie's Heights, which witnessed the heaviest fighting of the battle. On the lowest terrace, you'll find a reconstructed section of a pontoon bridge, the type the Union Army used to span the river. Union engineers constructed 6 bridges in all, 2 of them on the river just below Chatham. If you stand next to the reconstructed bridge and look through the gap in the trees, you'll see the stretch of river where the bridges rested. We'll be heading there next. Take time now to visit Chatham and its grounds. Once you're finished, there are 2 ways to exit. If you're traveling in a large vehicle, like a bus or a camper, return to Route 3 by the way you came in, being careful of traffic that's coming the other way. However, if you are driving a smaller vehicle, like a car, van, or SUV, exit the property using the gravel road that passes in front of the greenhouses. It will take you around the front of the house to a road that runs along the river. Once there, turn left and proceed to the intersection. That will bring you back to Route 3 at the Chatham Bridge. Once there, turn right and cross the bridge, staying in the right-hand lane. At the first stoplight, turn right onto Sophia Street. Go 1 block and turn left onto Amelia Street. At the first stoplight, turn right onto Caroline Street. Drive 3 blocks and turn right again onto Hawk Street. Park near the end of Hawk Street on the left.
Beep.
You are now standing at stop 3, the Upper Ponting crossing site. General Robert E. Lee commanded the Confederate Army in Virginia. Lee had an uncanny ability to predict his opponent's moves, but at Fredericksburg, Burnside got the better of him. By the time Lee discovered that his opponent intended to cross the Rappahannock River at Fredericksburg, it was too late to stop him. Lee accordingly made preparations to fall back to the North Anna River, 25 miles farther south. Only after he discovered that Burnside had delayed crossing the Rappahannock did Lee order Longstreet's corps to Fredericksburg. Lee would have preferred to fight at the North Anna. Fredericksburg offered him a splendid defensive position, but it gave him no opportunity to attack. Union artillery situated on Stafford Heights, across the river, effectively dominated the river valley, making it impossible for Lee to get at the enemy without taking heavy casualties. The terrain at the North Anna, on the other hand, was such that he could not only make a strong defense, but also mount an effective counterattack. Consequently, Lee preferred to fight there. But the Confederate president, Jefferson Davis, had other ideas. For political rather than military reasons, Davis felt it important to hold the Rappahannock line and instructed Lee to do so, if at all possible. Lee obediently directed his army to Fredericksburg. Longstreet's corps began pouring into the Fredericksburg area on November 19th, 2 days after Sumner's arrival. Longstreet placed his troops on the hills behind the town, just outside the effective range of Union guns on Stafford Heights. Jackson lingered near the Blue Ridge for several more days, and then he too headed east to join Lee at Fredericksburg. When Jackson's corps arrived, it took position on Lee's right, between Hamilton's Crossing and Port Royal. It was Jackson's arrival on December 3rd that prompted Burnside to cancel the crossing at Skinker's Neck and focus his efforts here. Burnside set December 11th as the date for the crossing. At 3 a.m., Union engineers began quietly laying pontoon bridges at three points along the river, two bridges here at the upper end of Fredericksburg, one at the steamboat landing at the lower end of town, and two more at the mouth of Deep Run, 2 miles farther downriver. Burnside hoped to complete the bridges shortly after dawn and to have his army across the river later that day, but he did not take Confederate General William Barksdale into his calculations. Barksdale commanded a brigade of Mississippi troops posted in Fredericksburg. As soon as it was light enough to see, Barksdale's men opened fire on Burnside's engineers, driving them back to the Stafford shore. Union infantry and artillery on the opposite bluffs returned the fire. For more than 8 hours, 150 cannon threw shells into the town, toppling walls and setting buildings ablaze. But Barksdale's men doggedly stood their ground, thwarting the engineers' every attempt to finish the bridges. Burnside would have to try a different approach. General Henry Hunt suggested sending troops across the river in pontoon boats to secure a foothold in town. It was a perilous undertaking, but there was no alternative. Burnside agreed. At 2:30 p.m., 70 men of the 7th Michigan Infantry Regiment shoved pontoon boats into the water and began rowing across the river under fire. As the boats struck the riverbank in front of you, the soldiers leaped out, formed ranks, and then charged up the slope into town, engaging Confederates here in house-to-house fighting. Other Union troops followed, and at dusk, Barksdale had to relinquish the town and fall back to Marye's Heights. After a hard day of fighting, Fredericksburg was finally in Union hands. Speed was essential to the success of the Union plan. Rather than push his entire army across the river that night, however, Burnside waited until the following day, giving Lee an additional 24 hours to concentrate his army at Fredericksburg. Meanwhile, Union soldiers pillaged the shelled-out town. "Everything that they could not eat or wear, they destroyed in pure wantonness," declared one soldier. "Our cannonballs made devastation enough, surely, but after our troops had finished with them, nothing remained. I never felt so much disgusted with war as I did that day." While Burnside's forces looted Fredericksburg, the Confederates were on the march. South of town, two of Stonewall Jackson's divisions were moving into position on Longstreet's right, near Hamilton's Crossing. Jackson's remaining two divisions were on the road and would be up by morning. By the time Burnside finally made his attack on December 13th, Lee would have his entire army in place. The stage was set for a slaughter at Fredericksburg. Return to your car. Turn left onto Sophia Street, drive to the end of the road, and then turn left again. Proceed carefully across Caroline Street to the second intersection, Princess Anne Street. Turn left there and drive 0.7 miles to Lafayette Boulevard. On the way, you'll pass several old banks, churches, and public buildings used as hospitals by the Union Army. When you reach the stoplight at Lafayette Boulevard, proceed under the railroad overpass and drive 3 blocks to a stop sign at Dixon Street. Turn right there and get in the left-hand lane. Proceed 1 block to a stoplight at the junction of Route 2 and 17, also known as Charles Street. In the 1860s, this road was known as the Richmond Stage Road, or Bowling Green Road. Turn left and follow routes 2 and 17 south for 2 1/4 miles, when you will see a sign on your right for the Slaughter Pen Battlefield. Pull in there and turn your player back on.
Beep.
You are now at stop 4, the Slaughter Pen Farm. Stand facing the farm fields with your back to Route 2. General William B. Franklin commanded the Union troops south of town. On December 11th, while Sumner was fighting his way into Fredericksburg, Franklin threw 2 bridges across the river at Deep Run, 1 mile to your left rear. Confederate pickets fired on Franklin's engineers, wounding 5 men, but Union artillery on Stafford Heights quickly drove them away. By 11 a.m., Franklin had completed both bridges. On December 12th, his Grand Division poured across the river and took up a defensive position around the pontoons. That evening, Burnside met with Franklin and his 2 corps commanders, Generals John F. Reynolds and William F. Baldy Smith, to plot his strategy for the coming day. Franklin and his generals persuaded Burnside to make his primary thrust against Lee's right flank at Hamilton's Crossing, 2 miles to your left front. The heights near Hamilton's Crossing were not as formidable as those confronting Sumner. The generals felt that a dawn strike there, if supported by Hooker's Grand Division, might force the Confederates off the ridge. Burnside agreed and promised to send Franklin written orders later that night. However, Burnside's orders did not reach Franklin until nearly 8 o'clock the next morning, several hours after dawn. To make matters worse, the orders were vague and confusing. Franklin had intended to assail the heights with his entire force, but Burnside's orders seemed to call for a more modest attack. Placing a narrow construction on his orders, Franklin directed John Reynolds to assault the ridge with just 2 divisions. Reynolds selected General George G. Meade's Pennsylvania Division to lead the charge, supported by a 2nd Division led by General John Gibbon. Together, Meade and Gibbon had just 8,500 men, less than 8% of Burnside's total force. Meade's men stepped off shortly after 8 a.m. They marched downriver, past your left, then wheeled right, forming a line of battle parallel to the Richmond Stage Road, modern Route 2. Open fields led from the Rappahannock River, 1/2 mile behind you, to the RF&P Railroad, 1/2 mile to your front. Beyond the railroad, the ground rose to a wooded ridge called Prospect Hill. Hidden among the trees there was Stonewall Jackson's corps of Lee's army. In order to get at Jackson, Meade first had to cross the road. Deep ditches and thick hedgerows bordering the road made this a difficult task. Union pioneers rushed forward with axes to hack holes in the forbidding vegetation. They then threw the branches into the adjacent ditches, providing makeshift bridges over which the artillery could cross. Meade cleared the Richmond Stage Road in 20 minutes and formed his division in the fields to your left front. Simultaneously, Gibbon's division crossed the road in this vicinity and prepared to support Meade on the right. Stonewall Jackson's Confederates watched the Federal deployment from Prospect Hill. Beyond Jackson's right, the heights dropped down to a flat plain that extends south to Massaponics Creek, 2 miles to your left. 2 brigades of General Jeb Stuart's Confederate cavalry guarded the plain, supported by the guns of Major John Pelham's horse artillery. As Meade crossed the Richmond Stage Road, he exposed his left flank to Stuart's horsemen on the plain. It was an opportunity that the 24-year-old Pelham could not resist. Corralling a nearby cannon, he galloped out to an intersection 0.8 mile to your left, unlimbered, and began firing solid shot into Meade's unprotected flank, just 400 yards away. Pelham's actions stirred up a hornet's nest. Within minutes, more than 20 Union cannon were firing on the young Alabamian and his gun crew. Pelham gamely accepted the challenge, maintaining the unequal contest for more than 30 minutes. 3 times, Stuart sent orders for him to retire, but each time the young officer refused. "Tell the general I can hold my ground," he said. Finally, with his gun crew crippled and his ammunition exhausted, Pelham hitched up his gun and galloped off the field. It was among the finest exhibitions of courage that the war produced. Lee watched the uneven artillery duel from Jackson's headquarters on Prospect Hill. When told that Pelham commanded the Confederate gun, he remarked, "It is glorious to see courage in one so young." Lee later recommended Pelham for promotion to lieutenant colonel, but the gallant major would not live to wear his 2nd star. 3 months after the Battle of Fredericksburg, he was killed at Kelly's Ford, 20 miles upriver. The South had lost one of its bravest defenders. Before leaving the stop, you may wish to hike the interpretive trail that begins at the cluster of historical signs. This property is owned and interpreted by the Civil War Trust, a nonprofit group dedicated to saving endangered battlefield lands. When you're ready to go, continue down the Richmond Stage Road 1 mile farther to the stoplight at Benchmark Road, Route 608. Signs located near the corner describe Pellin's actions there on December 13th. Turn right onto Benchmark Road and proceed another mile or so to the stop sign at Mine Road. Turn right there and carefully cross the railroad tracks. General Lee made his headquarters along Mine Road in the winter following the battle. Take the road 2.2 miles to the stop sign at Lansdowne Road, Route 638. Turn right on Lansdowne Road and proceed down the hill. In 6/10 of a mile, as the road flattens out, you'll see a sign for the Park Tor Road, Lee Drive. Turn right onto Lee Drive and proceed 2 miles to the parking lot at the end of the road. Ignore the historical signs that you'll see along the way. We'll stop at them on our way back.
Beep!
You're now at stop 5, Prospect Hill. Walk over to the cannon and face the railroad. You're now standing at the southern end of the wooded ridge that you saw at the last stop. While the hill itself looks much as it did in 1862, the ground in front has changed dramatically. The cultivated fields that once stretched from here to the Richmond Stage Road, half a mile ahead of you, have now disappeared amidst trees and modern development. Stonewall Jackson held this ridge on December 13th, his right flank supported by Jeb Stuart's cavalry on the plain, 1/2 mile to your right. When Jackson's corps first reached Fredericksburg earlier in the month, Lee had sent it downriver to guard the area near Skinker's Neck. Later, when the Union Army crossed the river at Fredericksburg, Jackson hurried north to join Lee. A.P. Hill's and William Tolliver's division arrived here on December 12th, followed the next morning by Jubal Early's and D.H. Hill's troops. Jackson posted A.P. Hill's division in the front line, near the railroad, and supported it with the remaining divisions, which occupied the woods to your left and rear. Artillery bolstered Jackson's flanks. 14 guns of Colonel Reuben Lindsey Walker's artillery battalion anchored Jackson's right flank here at Prospect Hill, while other batteries supported Jackson's left at Bernard's Cabins, 1.5 miles to your left. The crescent-shaped gun pits that protected Walker's guns are still visible on this hill. 15 additional guns, commanded by John Pelham, took possession on the plain, 1/2 mile to your right. In an effort to knock out as many Confederate guns as possible before the attack began, John Reynolds ordered his artillery to shell these heights. 2 dozen Union guns peppered the ridge, but the woods here effectively concealed Walker's guns, making them difficult to hit. After an hour, Reynolds halted the bombardment and ordered Meade's infantry to advance. Confederates here on the ridge viewed the approaching Federal line with a mixture of fascination and dread. "I could see fully half the whole Yankee army," remembered one soldier. "It was a grand sight seeing them come in position this morning, but it seemed that that host would eat us up." When an officer on Stuart's staff expressed a similar concern to Stonewall Jackson, the general cut him short. "Major," he said, "my men have sometimes failed to take a position, but to defend one, never. I am glad the Yankees are coming." Jackson had good reason to be optimistic. His 35,000-man corps held just 1.5 miles of Lee's 7-mile-long line, giving him more than 4 men for every foot of line that he had to defend. With such a concentration of troops, Jackson felt sure he could throw back any attack sent his way. Confederate gunners on this hill nervously gripped their lanyards and waited for Meade's men to come within range. Captain David McIntosh commanded one of the batteries here. "What an awful suspense these last moments are," he recalled. "The gun is charged, lanyard in hand, the gunner at the trail, ammunition heaped in piles nearby, waiting for the order to fire. Minutes seem like hours. One holds his breath and then breathes hard. But at last the moment comes. A tree standing out by itself just beyond the line of the railroad has been fixed upon as the point which we will let them reach. A raise of the hand as the fatal tree is reached, and the 14 guns let loose at the same instant. From then on, it is load and fire, as fast as sponge and rammer and lanyard can do their work, and as fast as muscle and skill and consuming zeal can direct and control." The Confederate cannon fire stopped the Federals in their tracks. Meade ordered his men to lie down and again ordered Wainwright to shell the hill. For an hour, opposing gunners engaged one another in a noisy and destructive duel. Shot and shell screamed overhead, killing horses and disabling guns. The trees around our guns were literally torn to pieces, remembered one Confederate, and the ground plowed up. I have been several times covered with dirt and had it knocked in my eyes and mouth. At one point, the cannonade became so severe that Confederate gunners abandoned their pieces and sought shelter in the hollow behind you. Their commander, Captain Willie Pegram, refused to run. Wrapping himself in a Confederate flag, Pegram calmly strode up and down among the deserted guns in an effort to shame his men into returning to their posts. A soldier caught in the maelstrom remembered, "It was a time to test a man's courage." Pegram passed that test. After an hour, the Confederate cannon fire here slackened, and Meade again ordered his men forward. Confederate gunners, who had taken refuge in the woods to your rear, now raced back to their guns and fired into the onrushing blue lines. Union troops, in front of you, staggered by the blast, took refuge behind a stone wall located a short distance beyond the tracks, and returned the Confederates' fire. Farther to your left, near the point today marked by a stone pyramid, Union troops entered the woods, penetrating a gap in the Confederate line. Somebody had made a mistake. To reach the next stop, drive back up the Tour Road 1/2 mile to the pair of historical signs that you passed on your way to this stop. As you head north, you'll see a stone pyramid marking the point of Meade's penetration. A sign along the road will tell you more about this unusual monument.
Beep.
You're now at stop 6, the Federal Breakthrough. Step out of your car and walk over to the signs so that your back is to the road. As Meade's men entered the woods ahead of you, they penetrated a 600-yard-wide gap in General A.P. Hill's line that existed between the brigades of General James Lane and General James J. Archer. The ground there is marshy, and Hill did not think Union troops could pass through it. But just in case, he had Archer throw a thin line of skirmishers across the interval and place Brigadier General Maxie Gregg's South Carolina Brigade here on the ridge directly behind the gap. Gregg's men stacked their arms in a military road the Confederate engineers had cut through the woods to facilitate the movement of men, wagons, and artillery along the line. If the Federals attacked, Gregg's men could race down the hill and take position behind the railroad embankment, filling the gap between Lane and Archer. However, Meade's attack caught Gregg by surprise. As the Federals boiled up through the woods in front of you, some South Carolinians grabbed their rifles and began to fire. Gregg ordered them to stop, believing that the troops in front were Archer's skirmishers. He was wrong. Rather than retreat up the exposed hill slope to their rear, Archer's skirmishers had moved off to the right, using the railroad embankment for cover, thus exposing the South Carolinians here to attack. Gregg paid for his mistake with his life. As he tried to rally his men, a Union bullet clipped his spine, inflicting a mortal wound. His brigade, caught off guard and deprived of his leadership, scattered. Some Union troops pushed past this point into the woods behind you in pursuit of Gregg's men. Others wheeled south, routing Archer's brigade and threatening Walker's guns to your right. Still others turned north and gnawed at Lane's exposed flank. Against all odds, Meade had broken Stonewall Jackson's line and seized the military road. But capturing the road was one thing, holding it was another. As soon as he had control of the hill, Meade raced back to the Richmond Stage Road to bring up reinforcements. He found just one small division there. Because Franklin viewed the movement as a reconnaissance in force rather than as an attack, he had not made any arrangements to exploit Meade's success. Meade would have to face the wrath of Jackson's counterattack alone. The Confederates reacted quickly to the Union breakthrough. Troops from Early's and Tolliver's divisions charged the Federals through the woods behind you, driving them back. Meade's division, outnumbered, tired, and disorganized, fell back through this area to the Richmond Stage Road, having lost 2 brigade commanders and nearly 40% of its men. One Confederate brigade rashly pursued the Federals out onto the plain beyond the railroad, but Union artillery quickly drove it back to the safety of the woods. By 2:30 p.m., most of the fighting on this front had ended. Franklin's attack had failed. Continue north along Lee Drive. In 1.5 miles, you'll come to a stop sign at Lansdowne Road. Proceed carefully through the intersection there and drive 2.4 miles farther to the Lee Hill parking lot located on the left side of the road. As you proceed north along Lee Drive, you'll see remnants of Confederate earthworks running parallel to the road. Most of these trenches were constructed in the days following Burnside's attacks and played no part in the December 13th fighting.
Beep.
You are now at Stop 7, Lee's Hill, General Robert E. Lee's headquarters during the Battle of Fredericksburg. From the top of the hill, you can see the town of Fredericksburg in the valley below. If you happen to come when the leaves are off the trees, and you have good eyes, you may be able to pick out Chatham, which appears on Stafford Heights, immediately behind the town. Closer to you, on the wooded ridge this side of Fredericksburg, a United States flag flies atop the National Cemetery at Marie's Heights. The hardest fighting in the battle took place along the sunken road at the base of those heights. Once Burnside committed himself to a battle at Fredericksburg, he had no choice but to make a frontal assault. Lee had anchored the flanks of his 7-mile line on two impassable bodies of water, the Rappahannock River on the north and Massaponax Creek on the south. To get around Lee, Burnside would have to return to Stafford County and recross the river at another point. Such a move would have been both dangerous and time-consuming. Instead, Burnside determined to stick to his plan and attack Lee at Fredericksburg. But why did he choose to attack Marie's Heights and Prospect Hill? The answer, quite simply, is that he had no better options. Formidable heights and an impassable canal deterred Burnside from making an attack north of Marie's Heights. South of the heights, the center of Lee's line bent back, forming a concave pocket. To attack there would have subjected Union troops to a galling fire from not one, but three directions. That left Burnside with just two possible points of attack, Marie's Heights and Prospect Hill. He attacked both. During the battle, Burnside made his headquarters at the Phillips House, 3/4 mile behind Chatham. From there, he could see little of the fighting at either Prospect Hill or Marie's Heights. To make decisions, he had to rely largely on information sent to him by subordinates at the front. Lee's headquarters, on the other hand, were closer to the action, giving him a good view of the battlefield, a far better view, in fact, than the one that you'll see today. Before the battle, Confederate pioneers had cut down trees on the front slope of this hill, allowing Lee to see more than half the battlefield. Yellow lines on the battle map at the top of the hill give some idea of the range of Lee's vision. James Longstreet joined Lee at this hill on December 13th. Longstreet, you'll recall, commanded the Confederate First Corps, which held the left and center of Lee's line. During the afternoon, the generals watched as brigade after brigade attacked Marie's Heights. Confederate commander feared that the repeated Union assaults might break Longstreet's line. Longstreet did not agree. "General," he said confidently, "if you put every man on the other side of the Potomac on that field to approach me over the same line and give me plenty of ammunition, I will kill them all before they reach my line. Look to your right," he said, referring to Jackson's front. "You are in some danger there, but not on my line." Lee and Longstreet shared this hill with Confederate artillery, including a 30-pounder Parrott rifle brought by train from Richmond specifically for this battle. The black-barreled gun atop the hill is an example of such a weapon. At 4,000 pounds, it was easily the largest gun on the battlefield. Its 3 1/4-pound powder charge could hurl a 30-pound bolt of iron more than 2.5 miles. The Parrott joined other cannons in the sector in shelling the left flank of Union troops attacking Marie's Heights. On the 39th round, however, the large gun burst, sending the front half of its barrel swirling down the hill and the rear half catapulting backwards into the woods. Although Lee, Longstreet, and dozens of other people were standing nearby when the weapon exploded, no one was injured. If you have time, I encourage you to take the short but strenuous walk to the top of the hill. Leave yourself at least 30 minutes for the round-trip hike. When you're finished, continue up the Tor Road for 0.2 mile to the stop sign on Lafayette Boulevard. Turn right and proceed through the stoplight at the Blue and Gray Parkway to the Fredericksburg Battlefield Visitor Center, approximately 0.6 mile away. Park your car in the parking lot behind the building.
Beep.
You are now at Stop 8, Marie's Heights. Step out of your vehicle and stand facing the stone wall with the parking lot behind you. Just ahead of you lies the sunken road, the key defensive feature of the Battle of Fredericksburg. This road was already 50 years old by 1862. Generations of wagon traffic had sliced into its unpaved surface, wearing it down several feet below the level of the surrounding hillside, actually giving it a sunken appearance. A stone wall, approximately 4 feet tall and 400 yards long, was later built along the road. The National Park Service has reconstructed the portion of the wall that you see here. An original section still stands just out of sight, 300 yards to your right. Confederate riflemen who occupied the road during the battle used the stone wall for cover as they poured volley after volley into Federal soldiers advancing behind you across what was then a broad open plain. Beyond the sunken road is Marie's Heights. 9 guns of the Washington Artillery of New Orleans, Louisiana, crowned this ridge in 1862. From their lofty position, the gunners were able to fire over the heads of Confederate riflemen in the road below and strike Union soldiers approaching from the town. Longstreet wanted to plant additional guns on the ridge, but his officers assured him that there was no need. "General," said one, "we cover that ground now so well that we will comb it as with a fine-tooth comb. A chicken could not live on that field when we open on it." The Confederate infantry position here in the sunken road, together with the artillery on Marie's Heights, made this perhaps the strongest natural defense position held by Lee's soldiers during the war. Responsibility for defending the sunken road fell to the Georgia Brigade of General Thomas Cobb. Cobb had left a brilliant legal career to fight for Southern independence. At Fredericksburg, he was waging his first battle as a brigadier general, and he was determined to make a good showing. When his superior, General Lafayette McLaws, sent him a dispatch before the battle, ordering him to fall back if the troops on his left gave way, Cobb cast it aside. "Well," he remarked, "if they wait for me to fall back, they will wait a long time." Family pride may have contributed to the general's stubborn attitude. Cobb's mother had grown up in Fredericksburg, and her house, Federal Hill, was visible from the general's position here in the sunken road. In a very real sense, Cobb was defending his family's own backyard. Cobb had perhaps 1,500 men here when the battle began. His men had just repulsed the first Union attack when a piece of shrapnel entered the general's thigh, severing his femoral artery. He died 2 hours later at a field hospital in the rear. With his wounding, command of the Confederate troops fighting in the sunken road fell to General Joseph Kershaw. Kershaw had started the day at Lee's Hill, but as the Federals intensified their attacks against Marie's Heights, Longstreet sent him to reinforce Cobb here at the sunken road. Kershaw's brigade arrived midway through the afternoon. Two of his regiments joined Cobb's men in the road. The others fired on the Federals from the crest of the hill. With these and other reinforcements, Confederate strength at Marie's Heights increased to 6,000 men, 3 times what it had been earlier in the day. In the sunken road, the soldiers stood 4 ranks deep. If the position had been strong at the start of the battle, it was impregnable now. We'll return to this area at the end of the tour, but right now leave the parking lot and turn left onto Lafayette Boulevard. Drive 1/2 mile to your first stoplight, Kenmore Avenue. Turn left onto Kenmore Avenue and keep to your left. In 1/4 mile, you'll come to a stoplight. Before reaching the stoplight, turn right onto Jackson Street. Proceed to the end of the street and turn left onto Hanover Street. As soon as you turn onto Hanover, park your car on the right side of the road and turn on your flashers. You should be facing a stoplight.
Beep.
You're now at stop 9, the mill race. At the time of the Civil War, Fredericksburg had several mills that were powered by an industrial canal situated just north of town. To carry away excess water from the canal, citizens built a mill race that flowed behind the town and emptied into the Rappahannock River not far from the train station. The mill race was 15 feet wide and about 5 feet deep, just wide enough and deep enough to be a problem for an advancing line of soldiers. After the war, the city paved over the mill race to create Kenmore Avenue, the street just ahead of you. 3 bridges crossed the mill race, one here at Hanover Street, another 1 block to your right at William Street, and a third 1/2 mile to your left, near the train depot. Here at Hanover Street, Confederate soldiers had removed planks from the bridge, leaving just the structure's supporting beams, or stringers. To cross the ditch, Union infantry had to break ranks, jump down into 3 feet of chilling water, and scramble up the muddy embankment on the other side, all the while under a murderous fire from Confederate artillery on Marie's Heights ahead. Once across the mill race, soldiers on the south side of Hanover Street, to your left, were able to find some shelter behind the now terraced hill slope visible just across the street. The hill quickly dropped away to the north, however, leaving Union soldiers to your right without any protection whatsoever. Getting past the canal ditch was just the first step. Once across, Union soldiers had to clamber up the slope ahead of you and charge 400 yards to reach the sunken road. The open ground across which they charged is now covered by houses, which were built after the battle. At the next stop, we'll see a house that was actually here in 1862. Before continuing the tour, you may wish to step out of your car and read the historical signs located at the intersection ahead of you. They go into more detail about the mill race and its impact on the battle. One of the signs features a photograph of this area taken 1 year after the fighting. When you're ready to go to the next stop, proceed carefully across Kenmore Avenue and turn left at the second street beyond the intersection, Little Page Street. Go about 70 yards and turn right onto Mercer Street. As soon as you make the turn, pull over to the right and stop your car.
Beep.
You're now at stop 10, the Stratton House. The brick building on your right is the Stratton House, a major landmark of the battle. Only the front of the house is original. The section to your right is a 20th century addition. In 1862, the Stratton House was just 4 years old. It had been built in 1858 by Alan Stratton, a Fredericksburg wheelwright. Like most Fredericksburg residents, Stratton and his family fled their house before the battle. It's fortunate they did, because the house stood at the very center of the fighting. To escape the torrent of rifle fire coming from the sunken road ahead of you, hundreds of Union soldiers crowded into the building or sought shelter behind its sturdy brick walls. Other Union soldiers found safety by lying face down in a small depression less than 50 yards behind you on the far side of Little Page Street. Post-war houses make this wrinkle in the landscape difficult to see, but if you look down the road behind you, you can see that the ground does in fact drop several feet in elevation. That small dip in the ground, running parallel to the sunken road, saved the lives of several thousand Union soldiers on December 13th. Next to Marie's Heights and the sunken road, it's the most important terrain feature on this part of the battlefield. Let's take a closer look now at the sunken road. Lock your car and walk straight ahead 100 yards or so until you reach the sunken road. Behind it stands a small white building known as the Innes House. Stand in the sunken road and look back towards your car, and then turn your player back on.
Beep.
You're now at stop 11, the sunken road. From where you're standing, you can see how the sunken road got its name. The road and the stone wall that borders it actually lie below the ground surface here, creating a ready-made trench that concealed and protected General Cobb's soldiers. Some Confederates took shelter in the Innes House. That the house did not provide nearly as much protection as the stone wall is evident from the dozens of bullet holes that still scar its interior walls. General Burnside did not intend to attack Marie's Heights until Franklin had achieved a breakthrough south of town. But when Franklin's attack fell behind schedule, Burnside impatiently ordered Sumner forward. Sumner had his men advance in a column of brigades, each brigade numbering approximately 1,500 men. Brigades were 200 yards apart. If the leading brigade faltered, the brigades behind it would sweep past the stalled unit and carry the enemy position. At least that was the theory. At noon, Sumner's 1st Brigade, commanded by General Nathan Kimball, filed out of town and formed a line of battle on this side of the mill race. Many of Kimball's men were new recruits and had never been in combat. As Confederate shells tore through their ranks, some of the soldiers got jittery. In an effort to encourage them, Kimball shouted, "Cheer up, my hearties, cheer up! This is something we must all get used to. Remember, this brigade has never been whipped, and don't let it be whipped today." Heartened by his words, the blue-coated soldiers started up the slope toward the heights. "How beautifully they came on," remembered a Confederate in the Washington artillery. "The bright bayonets glistening in the sunlight made the line look like a huge serpent of blue and steel. The very force of their onset leveled the broad fences bounding the small fields and gardens. But on they came as though they would go straight through and over us." Robert E. Lee, viewing a similar sight that day, remarked, "It is well that war is so terrible. We should grow too fond of it." Kimball's men saw much that was terrible that day. As they advanced toward you, shells from the Washington artillery, on the heights behind you, tore gaping holes in their lines. The brigade closed ranks and continued to press forward, men falling at every step. When the Federals reached a point 200 yards from the wall, Confederates here in the road poured a murderous volley into their ranks. Kimball and 25% of his men crumpled to the ground, dead or wounded. Those not hit threw themselves into the muddy swale and returned the enemy fire as best they could. The two brigades behind Kimball hurried forward, but they too fell apart under the crashing volleys of the Confederates here. Many Union soldiers broke ranks and ran for the rear. Others shouldered their way to the front, joining Kimball's men on the firing line, 150 yards ahead of you. They could do no more. Over the next 2 hours, Sumner sent a dozen brigades against the wall, one after another, only to see them shot to pieces. Darius Couch, commanding Sumner's 2nd Corps, watched the slaughter from the courthouse steeple in town. "I remember that the whole plain was covered with men," he wrote, "prostrate and dropping, the live men running here and there, and those in front closing upon each other, and the wounded coming back. I had never before seen fighting like that, nothing approaching it in terrible uproar and destruction. There was no cheering on the part of the men, but a stubborn determination to obey orders and do their duty." By 2 p.m., Sumner had lost 5,000 men in front of the wall, nearly a quarter of his force. 20,000 others, the remnants of four divisions, were pinned down on the plain in front of you, where they struggled to maintain a steady fire against the wall. Some soldiers pushed their blanket rolls in front of them for cover. Others sheltered themselves behind the corpses of dead horses or men. Couch sent a message back to Sumner at Chatham, urging him to halt the slaughter. "It is only murder now," he wrote. Burnside did not agree. From his headquarters at the Phillips House, the Union commander wired Franklin to renew his attacks at Prospect Hill. At the same time, he ordered Hooker to support Sumner's efforts at Marye's Heights. Franklin ignored Burnside's order. Hooker argued against it. Riding back to Burnside's headquarters, Hooker argued that renewed attacks against the wall could not succeed. But Burnside was adamant. As Hooker later wrote, the general insisted upon the attack being made. Hooker pushed forward several batteries to the outskirts of town in an effort to weaken the Confederate line, but their fire was ineffective. General Couch adopted a more desperate measure. At 3:45, he ordered his chief of artillery, Captain Charles H. Morgan, to send a battery across the Millrace to shell the Confederates at close range. Morgan couldn't believe his ears. Guns that close to the front would be easy targets for Confederate marksmen here behind the stone wall. "General," he protested, "a battery can't live there." "Then it must die there," Couch snapped. "General, you will lose your guns," Morgan exclaimed. "I would rather lose my guns than lose my men," Couch replied. "Put them in." Morgan selected Captain John Hazard's Rhode Island battery for the perilous task. Hazard's guns bounced across a makeshift bridge constructed across the Millrace at Hanover Street and went into battery on the bluff beyond. For 45 minutes, they blasted the Confederate line with shot and shell, all the while under fire from Confederate soldiers just 300 yards away. By the time the battery retired, it had lost 16 men and 15 horses. One cannon lost so many horses that it had to be brought off by hand. Meanwhile, Hooker prepared the Fifth Corps for a final assault against the stone wall. General Charles Griffin's division advanced to support the beleaguered Ninth Corps troops on the Union left, in the vicinity of the modern-day visitor center. "The troops moved toward the heights," wrote one soldier, "as though they were breasting a storm of rain and sleet, their faces and bodies being only half turned to the storm, with their shoulders shrugged." Griffin's men made it to the firing line, but they could not advance beyond it. Like thousands of Union soldiers before them, they threw themselves down in the mud and fired at the Confederates in the road ahead. General Andrew A. Humphreys commanded the last Union division to approach the wall. Like most Union generals that day, he attacked the stone wall one brigade at a time. He put in Colonel Peter Alabach's brigade first. As Alabach's men approached the Stratton House, they instinctively threw themselves onto the ground next to the soldiers who were already there and began firing. Although Humphreys got the brigade moving again, it had lost its momentum and stopped far short of the wall. Humphreys realized that it was futile to exchange fire with an enemy that was protected by a stone wall. If he was going to capture the sunken road, he would have to do so with cold steel. Galloping back to his remaining brigade, commanded by General Erastus Tyler, Humphreys ordered his men to fix bayonets. They were going to storm the wall. In the twilight, Tyler's Pennsylvanians swept up the plain toward the forbidding heights. Some Union soldiers, who had taken part in earlier attacks, shouted at Tyler's men to go back, lest they be slaughtered. Others grabbed the Pennsylvanians' legs as they passed and pulled them to the ground. Despite such obstacles, Tyler's men made it past the Stratton House to a point 50 yards from this wall. There, midway between the lines, they came under fire both from Confederate forces here and from Union forces in their rear. The brigade halted, fired a couple of volleys, and dissolved into the growing darkness. The last major assault against the wall had failed. "Having lost as many men as my orders required me to lose," Hooker commented bitterly, "I suspended my attack." Despite the drubbing he had received on December 13th, Burnside determined to renew his attacks on Marye's Heights the next day, personally leading his old Ninth Corps in the opening charge. Minutes before the attack was to begin, however, General Sumner came to Burnside and urged him to cancel the attack, arguing that no one in the army thought it could succeed. A council of war sustained Sumner's view. Burnside reluctantly set aside his plans for an attack and prepared to retreat across the river. Unaware of Burnside's decision, Confederate soldiers here at the wall remained on alert against further Union attacks. For 2 days, they exchanged fire with Union skirmishers who continued to occupy the swales 200 yards ahead of you. Caught between the lines were hundreds of Union soldiers, the victims of Burnside's December 13th attacks. The wounded men cried out for water, but no one could help them, for to expose oneself meant almost certain death. Nevertheless, Sergeant Richard Kirkland of the 2nd South Carolina Volunteers decided to try. Although the wounded soldiers in front of the wall were his enemies, Kirkland could not bear to see them suffer. Filling several canteens with water, he dashed out onto the plain amid a hail of gunfire until he reached the nearest Union soldier. Kneeling down, he gave the wounded man a drink. When the Union skirmishers saw what Kirkland was doing, they stopped firing at him and cheered. For the next hour and a half, the 19-year-old South Carolinian pursued his errand of mercy and safety. Sadly, he survived the Battle of Fredericksburg, only to die at Chickamauga 9 months later. The monument to your left commemorates the bravery and compassion of the soldier now known as the Angel of Marie's Heights. Return to your vehicle now and turn left onto Willis Street. Just before you reach the end of the street, you will see an entrance to the National Park Service Visitor Center parking lot on your right. Park there and face Marie's Heights.
Beep.
You are now at stop 12, the Fredericksburg Battlefield Visitor Center. Burnside maintained his position in front of Marie's Heights for 2 days before retreating back to Stafford County. On the night of December 15th, Union soldiers quietly formed ranks and slipped across the Rappahannock River over waiting pontoons. Gusting winds and rains helped conceal the movement from Confederate ears. When the last regiment was safely across, Union engineers cut the Fredericksburg ends of the bridges free, and the current pushed them smoothly to the Stafford shore. Burnside and his army would live to fight another day. Altogether, the Army of the Potomac lost 12,600 men at Fredericksburg, twice the number suffered by Lee. Here at the Stone Wall, the casualty ratio had been even greater. For every Confederate soldier killed or wounded at Marie's Heights, 8 Union soldiers had fallen. 2 days after the retreat, Burnside set a burial party back across the Rappahannock under a flag of truce to bury the Union dead. The soldiers interred their fallen comrades in 2 long burial trenches located near the Stratton House. Others were tossed into an ice house located just east of the mill race. There they remained until the end of the war, when the federal government reburied them in a new national cemetery located on Marie's Heights. The entrance to that cemetery is just across the sunken road, 200 yards ahead of you. I encourage you to visit there before you leave. Confederate soldiers killed at Fredericksburg are buried in the Confederate cemetery located on Washington Avenue downtown. Bad as the Union casualties were at Fredericksburg, the carnage here might well have been worse. For 2 days after the battle, 50,000 Union soldiers were packed into the town. Had Lee shelled Fredericksburg with his artillery, many more Union soldiers might have died. As it was, he remained on the defensive in the hope that Burnside would renew his attacks. At any other battlefield, Lee might have followed up his victory with a counterattack in the hopes of destroying the Union army. But at Fredericksburg, that wasn't possible. Union artillery on Stafford Heights would have broken up any Confederate assault before it reached the town. Lee was fully aware of that and consequently remained on the defensive. The crushing victory that he sought would have to wait. It would also have to come against another general. 5 weeks after Fredericksburg, Burnside resigned as the Army of the Potomac's commander, and President Lincoln appointed Joe Hooker to take his place. Hooker rebuilt the army and restored its confidence. By the spring of 1863, it was again ready to take the field. After 4 months of calm, Fredericksburg and the surrounding area would once again feel the shock of battle. This concludes your tour of Fredericksburg Battlefield. I hope you've enjoyed our time together. For a list of other podcast tours available at this park, inquire at the Visitor Center.